Thank you for standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I must advise you that this webinar is being recorded today. We now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Tracy, and good morning to everyone. Welcome to Capital Link's webinar series. I'm Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link. Today's webinar is a roundtable discussion on the dry bulk sector. We're delighted to have with us our featured panelists, Robert Bugbee, President of Scorpio Bulkers, Polys Hajioannou, Chief Executive Officer of Safe Bulkers, and Hamish Norton, President of Star Bulk Carriers Corporation. The moderator for today is Amit Mehrotra, Director of U.S. Transportation and Shipping at Deutsche Bank. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then also will be available as an audio archive through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. After the discussion, there will be a live Q&A session. Webinar participants can submit questions through the sidebar on the presentation page titled Submit a Question, or they can email them to us at questions@capitallink.com. Please note you can submit a question at any time during the event, and your question will be replied during the Q&A session. The discussions and opinions expressed by the panelists are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the panel discussion may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. Capital Link has made a strategic commitment to shipping and the maritime sector. In addition to our annual conferences and weekly shipping newsletters, we hold industry webinars and podcasts on a regular basis. To access our webinar library for past and upcoming webinars, please visit webinars.capitallink.com. And in closing, please save the date for our 12th Annual Shipping and Marine Services Forum on Tuesday, September 10, 2019 in London at 116 Pall Mall. Thank you to all for participating. We actually have huge attendance for this dry bulk webinar. And without any further delay, I will turn the floor to Amit, and thank you to everybody for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Amit. Nicolas. Thanks, Nicolas. This is a great event, obviously, put on by Capital Link. We appreciate you and Capital Link having Deutsche Bank being a small part of it. So welcome, everybody. Good morning, afternoon, evening, depending on where you are in the world. I'm very pleased to moderate this discussion on the dry bulk market with three industry leaders, all well-respected in the dry bulk arena, and we'll have a wide-ranging discussion on the demand outlook, the supply dynamics, regulation vis-a-vis IMO 2020, and we'll end with talking about some risk management and capital structure. Let me introduce our guests, just providing a little bit more meat around what Nicolas said. In alphabetical order, we have Robert Bugbee, who is the president of Scorpio Group, which of course runs the largest product tanker company in the world, Scorpio Tankers, but more relevant for this discussion is also president of Scorpio Bulkers. Next, we have Hamish Norton, president of Star Bulk, the largest dry bulk company in the world. Hamish has a very long and distinguished career in the ship and ship finance business, and we're very excited to have him on the call today. And last but certainly not least, we have Polys Hajioannou from Safe Bulkers. Polys and Safe Bulkers are amongst the most well-respected ship owners in the industry. So, Polys, thank you so much for joining us as well. Interestingly, the equity values of these three companies each are up about 30% in the last 30 days. They're also all of them up on a year-to-date basis as well. I don't know when's the last time I said that about a dry bulk stock. So clearly equity values for dry bulk companies are catching a wave here, pun intended. The question, of course, is how big the wave is, how sustainable it is, and hopefully we get a better sense of that on today's call. So with that, I just want to get right into it. I want to start with the outlook for dry bulk demand. We can begin with China, given how critical China is to the overall demand environment. China's PMI has been below 50 or in contraction territory for the majority of 2019. But interestingly, dry bulk vessels continue to improve. You know, Hamish, maybe we can start here. If you could just talk about the drivers and sustainability of the recent strength in rates, especially in the context of what you're seeing in China and the weaker China data. Hamish, why don't we start there? Thanks.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, China is weaker in some sectors, but not in crude steel and pig iron production, which is what's directly related to iron ore consumption. You know, in the first half, it's up like 10% year on year in terms of crude steel and pig iron production. And we're still in the early part of the high production season, so that, you know, iron ore consumption for the next quarter at least is expected by us anyway to remain high. And the Chinese have prepared a fiscal stimulus, which seems to be targeted at the effect that the tariffs would be estimated to produce on its GDP. And, you know, their fiscal stimulus has almost always involved things that subsidize steel production, such as infrastructure and real estate. And, you know, so we're seeing no shortage of demand from China. And then, you know, right now, Cape sizes have an interesting situation. People were afraid to ballast to Brazil. And so there is a significant shortage of capes in the Atlantic, which is where the demand for iron ore movements is right now. And so for the next 50 days, what we see is that the VLOCs controlled by Vale have all loaded and are heading east laden. And there are no capes. So we've got 50 days of almost guaranteed high capesize rates, while the Brazilians ramp up their production, which they seem to be doing pretty quickly.
Right, and there's, I mean, just to follow on to that, and I'll move on to Paulus for a minute to get his thoughts, but there's also the substitution effect going on with Vale, you know, having 50 million tons of supply offline. Are you seeing this diversification of Cape demand, given other regions, South Africa, for example, kind of stepping up and filling that iron ore seaborne demand?
A little bit. But, you know, I think most recently the driver of high charter rates has, in fact, been Brazilian need for spot ships.
Okay.
Yes. If I may add, thank you for the question. If I may add to what Hamish said, I think it's all Brazil right now. It's coming, the big play is coming from Brazil. We all know the ton mile effect of every new cargo that Vale puts in the market. Right now, the demand is good for iron ore. This is our belief. That's why we see also the price of iron ore reaching record high levels. Earlier in the week, last week, it was up to $125 a ton. And this may increase further. There are reports that we could see it in the next couple of months up to $150. So the price of iron ore isn't going up. Wouldn't be going up if there was not strong demand in China. So this is optimistic. On the other hand, I see all the sectors. I always was saying that second half of the year will be very strong, I believe, from the start of the year, despite the very low market, simply because we have very, very little increase of supply in the second half of the year. We have the scrubber effect that keeps ships in the yard, and also the smaller sizes will start benefiting from this lack of cape sizes in the Atlantic that Hamish was speaking. So we are seeing now post-Panamaxes in the Mediterranean being able to achieve rates of $26,000-$27,000 a day for trips from Black Sea to go to the Far East. These are cape size cargoes that are split in the middle. And the knock-on effect on smaller sizes like post-Panamaxes has started. So we're entering into a healthy territory.
Yeah. Robert, maybe I can get you in here and just follow on that, given the size and makeup of your fleet. Maybe you can just provide some color, initial color at least, on the demand picture as you see it today.
Yeah, I agree with Paulus and you know, Hamish, that we're also seeing You know, we're certainly not seeing, you know, first of all, China fall apart. I mean, we're even take soybeans. I mean, Chinese soybean imports are down year on year, but not nearly as much as people would think, given the impact of swine flu, for example. And U.S. soybean imports in China are almost higher from January than May 2019 than the whole of 2018. If you take wheat exports, U.S. wheat exports are up 26%, nearly 27%, with majority of those imports going to the Far East, Philippines, Japan, Indonesia, South Korea. I mean, one of the benefits, let's say, of these, of the uncertainty that's surrounding U.S.-China trade is that the surrounding economies in Asia have probably benefited from a little bit of the outsourcing and increasing growth in their markets, which is benefiting the overall dry cargo market, because you're getting a much more, you know, disparate and more customers. Russian grain exports are expected to increase 12% this year. And as Polis says, I mean, we're already seeing increasing cargoes in the Black Sea. You know, the Ukraine has had record harvest, over 70 million tons this year. On the coal side, India is growing great guns. I mean, India could import as much thermal coal in China as China in the whole of 2019. It's, you know, it's going to be pretty close.
Right.
So we've seen a steady group of optimism here.
We'll get into the coal market in a minute, but I wanted to maybe focus a little bit more on iron ore. Hamish, you talked about you know, China's steel production. You're absolutely right. China's been a very big exporter of steel. I think it's been growing 10% plus year on year to sort of record high levels. But what's interesting is China's steel production keeps to be growing, but yet iron ore imports, you know, were negative last year on a year-over-year basis, at least seaborne imports. And we've been anecdotally at least hearing about the increased use of, you know, more scrap metal for steel production. Can you just comment on that? Because it's interesting that iron ore inventories are at multi-year lows. Price for iron ore has increased partly because Vale is out of the market, at least a 50 million ton reduction in the market. So kind of just triangulate those.
At this point, it's not a 50 million ton reduction. At mm-hmm. this point, they're you know, at a run rate at or above last year's run rate.
Because the Brucutu mine has come back.
The 50 million reduction is roughly the reduction from the most optimistic forecasts we heard from mm-hmm. Brazil last year. In other words, that's 50 million of growth that we didn't get, but we've got now some growth.
Got it. And so you're, and also at the same time, inventories of iron ore are sitting at multi-year lows as well. So maybe
right.
That could
and
be.
Iron ore prices are, you know, quite high because obviously there's demand. I mean, you know, look, China clearly when they, you know, found themselves without the Brazilian supplies that they were expecting, you know, did two things. They worked off stockpiles, and they made do with domestic iron ore to some extent, you know, more than they had intended. But the domestic iron ore and the lower quality iron ore from sources other than Brazil and Australia, you know, leads to more air pollution, right? When you've got iron ore that's less iron and more dirt, a substantial amount of that dirt ends up in the air as you process it. And, you know, they just for environmental reasons, prefer to use the higher quality, higher percentage iron ore.
So it seems like, interestingly, the iron ore seaborne trade is quite robust this year. Is your expectation, I mean, your research people inside your company that are obviously close to this, is there any expectations internally, and we can go through down the line in terms of what iron ore seaborne import demand growth could look like this year, because it's such a critical piece of the dry bulk you know, demand equation.
Well, you know, basically, obviously, iron ore imports have been down in the first half of the year.
Right.
But, you know, based upon what we're hearing from Brazil in terms of their total production, for the whole of 2019, we're expecting significant growth in Brazilian exports from now, you know, from first half of the year to second half of the year. And at this point, we're seeing it.
Yeah. And Paulus, if I could just switch gears a little bit and talk about coal and bring in Robert as well. You know, there was obviously some restrictions on coal imports into China during the winter months that weighed pretty heavily on the markets. You know, if you could just talk about the current state of the coal trade and how maybe we should think about it from, you know, a cyclical perspective kind of over the next 6 months or so, and then also maybe more secularly as China kind of diversifies away from, you know, fossil fuels.
Okay, I'll ask
yes. Look,
sorry, yeah. Let's get Paulus in here, and then Robert, we can go to you on that too. Thanks.
Okay, our company, we have mid-sized vessels, Panamax, Kamsarmax, Post-Panamax, so coal movement, coal cargo is the majority of our cargo, coal and grain. We see a lot of coal movement to Southeast Asia, countries like Vietnam and Philippines and other countries that they are filling in the gap, as well as big movement, especially over the past two or three months before the monsoon season into India. So these markets are doing very strong. Now, coal in China, there is some fluctuation from time to time. Also, there are some political-driven campaigns in China, and we are experiencing some delay of our ships carrying Australian coal into Chinese port. But Japan is doing very well on coal imports. India was doing very well up until the monsoon started. Vietnam, Philippines, all these countries are importing big quantities of coal. That's why also we see the Kamsarmax market, Panamax market, $12,000-$13,000 a day in the past few weeks. So,
okay.
As far as China is concerned, we know that this the annual going rate is 270 million tons. I don't expect to see big movements either upwards or downwards on this.
Robert, thank you. Yep, that makes sense, Paul. So, Robert, do you want to add anything to that?
No, not really.
Okay, good. So it looks like we have a lot of ground to cover on this 45-minute call, so I want to make sure I move quickly. So it looks like the demand side of the dry bulk kind of equation is quite positive. Iron ore, coal, grain, it all seems like now that we're through this seasonally weaker period exacerbated by what happened in Vale in the first half, now towards a more seasonally stronger period in the back half. So that's actually, for me at least, more surprisingly positive coming out of this call than I would have thought, you know, before the call started. So that's good. I want to move on to probably what the 350, 400 people on this conference call that have dialed in this webinar are probably wondering, is what the impact of IMO 2020 is going to be on each of your businesses. You know, first, I want to talk about the scrubber strategy and the commercial strategy and all that stuff. But first, I wanted to start with, you know, maybe get in Robert here and just how IMO 2020 is going to impact the dry bulk industry. I think there's been a lot of focus on product tankers and the tanker industry in general, and that makes sense. But I'd love to get your sense on how you think IMO 2020 impacts the dry bulk sector from your perspective.
I think the most, you know, obvious effect is going to, you know, make a differentiation between those vessels that firstly have you know, lower fuel consumption than their sisters, as the fuel pricing is going to be higher, and those vessels that have scrubbers, and those vessels that don't, as the high sulfur fuel is going to be considerably cheaper than the low sulfur fuel. So if you have a modern vessel that's fuel efficient and a scrubber, it's going to be considerably more efficient than an older vessel without a scrubber.
Do you see broader implications, though? So I get the arbitrage of the scrubbers and the fuel price spread, and we can get into that in a minute. But I'm more talking about, you know, how the entire dry bulk fleet evolves in an environment where fuel prices are significantly higher. And so a larger percentage of the Capesize fleet will have scrubbers installed, but in the medium to smaller size vessels, a very small percentage of the fleet will have scrubbers installed. And so the question is really is that, you know, there was a point where slow steaming made a lot of sense as your fuel costs relative to your charter costs were a lot higher, but you could argue that, you know, the fleet's pretty slow already or was slow over the last 6 months. And so help me think about how you think charterers will change their behavior given their costs of fuel and energy go up.
Right. So Paul is just earlier on the call mentioned that in the Mediterranean you're getting splitting of Cape cargoes into smaller size vessels. So you're going to increase the rate at which if the Capes are the ones that are most efficient with scrubbers, you're going to alter all of those economics, and that's what's going to be so important from the customer's point of view and the rates, because the customer cares on his shipment cost per ton. So at the moment, your decision as to whether or not you're going to split a Cape cargo is going to be, it will be one rate, but if you have a Cape market that is, based off a cost structure partly because of scrubbers versus smaller size vessels where hardly anybody has scrubbers, then that's going to alter, again, to the benefit of those vessels that are most efficient, the pricing decision of the customer when taking the ship.
I haven't heard that before. That's interesting. So there's like a cascading down of demand towards, and Hamish, I want to get you in here for a second and see.
That's simply why it's not a simple calculation as, you know, and that's what we see in other, and that's what we have done related to the product tanker market. It's not as simple as saying, oh, well, the only reason ships you put scrubbers on are the big Capes because they're the ones that carry the most cargo and use the most fuel. You have to think of the cascading and the substitution part of how the market operates as well.
Yeah, that's insightful. Hamish, I haven't heard this cascading kind of thought before. Maybe I've been out of the loop a little bit on it, but any thoughts there? Because I think that's kind of an interesting perspective.
Well, we're putting scrubbers on all of our Supramaxes.
Yep.
So that's,
yeah, but I would argue economically, like even if you burn 20 tons of fuel a day, that the return on even a smaller ship, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Well, that's another way to say what Robert just said. You know, Robert is giving the underlying reason for why that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But, certainly agree with that analysis. But look, first of all, let's be clear. IMO 2020 is going to be good for every ship owner, including the ship owners who are not putting on any scrubbers. When a ship is burning low sulfur fuel, that is expensive fuel, and clearly the vast majority of the dry bulk fleet is going to be burning low sulfur fuel, and either charter rates go up or the fleet will slow down. Now, if the fleet slows down, not as much stuff can be carried, but you know, there's kind of an inflexible demand for the amount of stuff that needs to be carried. So what happens is the fleet cannot slow down if the same amount of stuff needs to be carried. The charter rate has to go up to match the increase in the fuel price.
But,
and so everybody's going to benefit. People with scrubbers will benefit more probably.
I'm just going to push back a little bit on that because, I mean, you have a physics degree from Harvard, so you know this better than I do. But, when you slow a ship down from 18 knots to 11 knots, there's a lot of fuel efficiency savings. When you slow it down from 11.5 knots to 8 knots, it's less so. It's not linear, right? And so
the fuel savings on a route is proportional to the square of the speed.
Yep.
Right? So, basically the charterer is going to tell your ship, if you put your ship out on time charter, the charterer wants to minimize the sum of the amount he pays for the charter of the ship plus the amount he pays for the fuel. And, you know, if the fuel is expensive and the charter rate is low, he's going to say, okay, I want that ship to go slower, so I pay for more days of charter and less fuel. Whereas
right.
if the charter rate is you know, low,
Yeah, I have a lot of specific IMO 2020 questions, but I want to get Paulus in here at a high level at least, just get his thoughts as well on how IMO 2020 will impact the broader dry bulk market, and then we can get into some specifics about open and closed roof scrubbers and all that good stuff. Paulus?
Yes, thank you, Amit. Yes, look, I think as Hamish said, the expensive fuel price is good for the market. Every time the fuel price going up, we see positive development on the freight market. Freight rates go up, and also time charter rates go up. So having to burn compliant fuel on most of the world fleet, it means likely that we will have a higher fuel oil price, which will increase freight rates. If this is via reduction of speed, it will be via reduction of speed. And I don't agree with your comment you made that in container ships is the biggest benefit because 18 knots will become 11 knots. Also on dry bulk, you know, 12 knots, if you reduce just by half a knot the whole fleet, it's 4% less available supply. 4% less available supply can make huge difference. Remember,
I understand that, Paulus, but the question is, going from 11.5 to 11 knots, does it save you a proportional amount of fuel? Because that's the driver
It could save you on a Panamax 3 tons. And of course, this is a charter to decide if it makes sense for him and at what cost it makes sense for him to reduce the speed. But
Got
what
it.
I want to say is that the people who put scrubbers on their ships, of course, they are taking a risk initially. But also, you have to consider the optionality this equipment gives to your ship, because here you have a vessel that you can convert a previously non-attractive vessel, like burning 25 tons of fuel oil on a Panamax, which couldn't compete with the new generation of ultra eco new ships. You could make it compete, because suddenly the ship will become 40% cheaper on fuel consumption. So it's all this optionality that you get with this piece of equipment, and also the comparison between Capesize and the smaller ship. You have to bear in mind that the smaller ship, the equipment is costing much less than the Capesize. It could cost maybe $500,000 less to install it on the smaller ships, like the Ultramax or the Panamax.
So the returns
so
might not
I
be as impacted.
Overall, for ship owners who move early enough in 2018 to get the slots for 2019, because as you know right now, we are fitting scrubbers, and we hope that by December we will be all done. And this is a big success.
Yeah, I want to get into that, because I know. Robert and Scorpio Bulkers and Star Bulk Strategy is all scrubbers for all their vessels. I'm a little bit uncertain. So you've said that you're going to do, I think, 50% of your Panamax plus Panamax fleet. You obviously have some Capes. I wasn't sure if you're fixing those with scrubbers. Obviously, age also has some bearing here. But if you could just talk to us about how you're approaching it from a scrubber investment perspective.
Yes, ourselves, we decided we had a certain budget for this project, which was around $50 million. We didn't want to go to $100 million and fit out the whole fleet, because also for us it was an unknown territory. We believed in this project. We decided to move with a very reliable equipment maker like Alfa Laval on all our fleet, and ensure that we get 2019 slots. So we fitted all our post-Panamax fleet, which is ships burning 30, 35 tons a day, which are in big demand when Capesize rates going up. We are fitting our free Capesizes, The long period capesizes, it's up to the charterer. One of them is fitting, the others are not fitting. And we are fitting on our heavier consumption Kamsarmaxes, which are the ones we built in China. We are not fitting it on the older ships and on the ships that they are eco design and they are burning very, you know, 16, 17 or 18 tons of fuel oil. We are not fitting on those. That's how we select it. So we went on all the post-Panamaxes and on the heavier consumption Kamsarmaxes.
On the capes that you have on long charter, where the charters, is that an investment the charter is making, and do they keep the savings and the rate you charge on the long-term charter stays the same? Is that how it works?
Okay. Yes, one of the three charters did this investment. He paid himself, and he will get all the benefit himself. We just facilitate the technical stuff and the, you know, the engineering coordination to make it work for him to get the maximum advantage.
Okay, thank you. I want to move to Hamish and then Robert and talk about scrubbers. To be fair, a lot of what I've learned on the scrubber side or exhaust gas cleaning side, more than I would have thought I would have learned 2 years ago, is actually because of Hamish Norton and his expertise in the scrubber field and his work that he's done on it. So I wanted to, one, ask maybe a very basic question that might seem very basic, but I think it's an important question, is one, do you think the IMO 2020 regulation is a complete done deal and it's going to occur on January 1st, 2020? I know the answer is yes, but I just want to ask it in case there's any nuance there.
There's not a lot of nuance. It's going into effect. It's going into effect January. Between January 1 and February 28th, there will be some wiggle room that not a lot of people will take advantage of, we think, but there will be some wiggle room. As of March 1st, there will be no wiggle room, because as of March 1st, ships will not be allowed to carry high sulfur fuel.
And so the carriage ban would not be, is the carriage ban not valid between, you know, the 6 weeks or 8 weeks
months.
Rather?
Months. For January and February of 2020, there is no carriage ban. The carriage ban goes into effect March 1st.
Got it. And then the next question related to that is really about the open loop versus closed loop debate. So I know you have done a lot of work just talking about the ecological impact of dumping sulfur in the water and the international seas. And
first of all, what people need to understand is that open loop and closed loop scrubbers both dump the same precise amount of sulfur into the ocean. Closed loop scrubbers dump all the sulfur into the ocean.
Yeah.
Closed loop scrubbers operate with a lower volume of water, and so they are thought to be, better at cleaning the water that is being discharged, but not cleaning it of sulfur. The sulfur goes into the ocean. It is possible to put a filter on the output of an open loop scrubber as well, and we're, looking into that.
Just staying on that topic, there have been some ports, when you fly into Singapore, for example, there's a very dense area of ships in a small particular area, which is why I would imagine that open loop scrubbers could be banned. The use of open loop scrubbers could be banned in ports and inland waterways because there's just more density of ships that could impact, the ecological environment more so than international waters. One, is that the right reason for why these bans are? And at the end of the day, I think it's a really important question to ask. What are the chances, Hamish, in your mind, that the IMO bans or some regulatory body bans the use of open loop scrubbers in international seas? Because that could be a critical kind of debit to any shipping company's capital that has to then convert open to closed loop.
Yeah. Well, look, there are, of course, certain ports that have banned the operation of open-loop scrubbers in port. So first of all, when we did our economic analysis of scrubbers, we assumed that we would not be able to use open-loop scrubbers in port, but would use compliant fuel in port. Is it the right thing for the ports to do? We don't think so, frankly. we think that the ports have not been basing their decisions on you know, actual evidence, but have been using something called the precautionary principle, which is, you know, we don't know, so we're going to ban it. You know, the Japanese government did a study on the effect of open loop scrubbers in Japanese ports and concluded that there would be no impact on the water in the port, and furthermore that there would be a significant impact on the air, because the scrubber doesn't, you know, just remove sulfur. It removes polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. It removes particulate matter from the exhaust stream, which, by the way, is in the exhaust stream even if you use compliant fuel. So, you know, the question is, which do you care more about, some hypothetical pollution in the port water or some actual measurable pollution of the port air, which is clearly helped by scrubbers?
No, I understand that, you know, there's some studies about it, but I guess at the end of the day, do you think any regulatory body, it's you know, probability-wise, highly unlikely that it gets
banned?
Well,
look, we obviously can't rule out that for political reasons the IMO might at some point ban open-loop scrubbers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, first of all, it will take them a long time to do that.
And it's a 50% uplift in cost, so if scrubber fully installed costs $2 million, you're talking about maybe another $1 million investment to convert it to
closed loop
if they're able to do that?
Well, okay, so if they ban open-loop scrubbers but don't ban closed-loop scrubbers, our scrubbers, as well, I believe, as the scrubbers that Scorpio Bulkers is putting in and Safe Bulkers is putting in, are easily converted to closed-loop.
Okay. That's helpful. Let me get Robert in here as well and just pivot a little bit onto the availability of fuel. So obviously with your scrubbers, you need high sulfur fuel. And I just wonder, you and Cam, how you guys think about this, because there's obviously possibly going to be, if refinery runs are going to increase and utilization is going to increase, there's just going to be more high sulfur fuel that's going to be out there. But there's always obviously questions about where you store it. And how you source it, and so how do you guys approach that kind of, you know, 6 months ahead of this IMO regulation? What kind of work are you guys doing to be able to source high sulfur fuel? Is that just not even an issue in your mind?
So just quickly, I just want to clarify something that Hamish said earlier about what's going to happen between December 31 and March 1st. You have leeway to have the high sulfur fuel on board your ship without scrubbers, just to carry it because you may have had it as a residual before and not been able to get rid of it, but you don't have leeway just to burn it. So, you know, people are going to have to plan way ahead of December 31st to get this low sulfur fuel on board ships and using it if they don't have the scrubbers. But to your sort of question, you know, what we're doing across, you know, all of our fleets, and here we have some advantage because, you know, we're going to end up with, you know, pretty near, you know, 200 ships with pool partners, et cetera, that will have scrubbers, is that we're exploring contracts to, you know, that will supply the heavy fuel for the scrubber-fitted vessels. But in general, the simple answer is that we don't see it as a problem to, you know, to get hold of the heavy fuel. We see there being quite a surplus to begin with, which will press the spread wider, i.e. heavy fuel will go down in pricing compared to the low sulfur fuel.
Right. And Hamish, I guess you still have to obviously burn low sulfur fuel when you operate in around ECAs. Or emission control areas. So,
can you
talk about the
With a scrubber, you can burn high sulfur fuel and scrub down to 0.1.
Yeah.
It's only in port where we'd have to burn low sulfur fuel in ports that don't permit open loop scrubber operation.
Yeah, but you're going to have to carry it regardless, right?
We're going to have to carry it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so can you just talk about the fuel availability? Just the same question I asked Robert, because I'm curious about how you guys are approaching the fuel availability of high sulfur fuel, or if that's even an issue or it's not an issue because it will be widely available.
Well, we suspect, as Robert suspects, that it's not an issue, but, you know, due to an abundance of caution, we are looking in, as he is looking into, the possibility of signing supply contracts for attractively priced high sulfur fuel. But, you know, what I suspect we will end up doing is, at least at the beginning of this period, buying more bunker fuel than we normally would, filling our tanks so that we have more sailing days before we have to refuel. So there's probably going to be some impact on our working capital. But, you know, clearly it's a high sulfur fuel will be available in any significant bunkering port.
Okay.
May not be available. Yeah.
Okay, that's helpful. Paulus, I wanted to bring you in, if I could, and just ask a quick question about chartering strategy for your scrubber-fitted vessels. I mean, the Hamish noted earlier is that IMO 2020 is good for all ship owners, and the point, I think the underlying premise there is that fuel inherently is not a cost borne by the ship owner. It's a cost borne by the time charter or the cargo owner. And, of course, there are ways of changing that vis-a-vis your chartering strategy, moving from time charters to more voyage charters, where you're taking control of the ship and where it goes and the fuel and things like that. So if you could just help us, and I'll go down the line because I think this is an important question, but we'll start with Paulus in terms of how you're thinking about changing your chartering strategy to actually keep more of the returns from the investment that you're making on the scrubbers.
First of all, I think that the market, the way it is, the way it has been the first half of the year, by definition, all the ship owners, most of the ship owners, will have a lot of ships in the spot market. Now, it would be silly to tie them up in long time charters or period charters of 1 year or 2 years before we know what the differential of the spread will be. And I don't think we will have a clear differential of the spread between HFO and compliant fuel, a clear picture before October at the best. So I wouldn't touch anything before October or fix any ship before October for any sort of period.
To be quite clear, that was not the question. The question was, when the spread is $250 to $300 per ton, how are you going to evolve your chartering strategy to keep more of the savings of that spread and not have to share it with the people that are chartering your ships?
Well, look, I mean, we will be an arbitrage there. You know, you will trade if the spread is $300 a ton. Of course, you will start fixing ships, and you'll try to arbitrage the benefit you pass on to the charter versus the period you get on a high charter rate for your ship. Of course, you wouldn't be like to do floating rates and things like that. You would like to do fixed rates for 3 years, for 2 years, for things like that, and then you pass certain benefit to the charterer. I mean, Everything will be decided on what the actual spread it is. Nobody knows now. And we had some approaches, you know, in the last couple of months to discuss, but since we don't know what the spread will be, there's no basis for discussion. So
okay,
in October,
no, that's
we will
fair.
Know more. I mean, some ships will try to keep in the spot market and in the voyage market to take the maximum advantage. But this is not always possible because, you know, the Panamax, post-Panamax market is time charter orientated. So there
right.
will be some sharing with the charter, but not the sort of amounts I'm hearing, you know, things like 50-50 or 60-40.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Share.
Yep, that makes sense. And Hamish, Starbulk has created a logistics arm based in Geneva, which is probably not coincidentally right next door in Geneva to one of the largest cargo charters of ships in the world. And so what is the thought process there in terms of how you're going to, you know, realize the returns that you have on paper related to these large scrubber investments?
Well, you know, our logistics arm is just one of the initiatives we've implemented to put our fleet basically on voyage charter.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, we intend for our entire fleet, or as near to the entire fleet as we can arrange, to be on voyage charter as of the beginning of 2020, so that the fuel is our expense and the fuel savings is our benefit.
Do you think 20? There's some numbers I've seen, 20 to 25% of the Cape fleet will be scrubber fitted. Is there kind of going to be this scrubber fitted index now versus the regular kind of Cape size index? Like, how does the market gain transparency around what the scrubber and non-scrubber rates are?
I have not heard any rumors that there will be a with scrubber Cape size index.
Okay.
In fact, just the reverse. I've heard that there won't be. You know, obviously that can change.
Isn't that surprising to you, given how much of the fleet will have scrubbers installed of the Cape size fleet?
I think that there were a lot of people who did not want a with scrubber index, and very few people who did want a with scrubber index. And I think
I would imagine
the Baltic people went with the majority of their clientele.
Right. Let me, Robert, this is an important topic, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. You know, how do you think the commercial strategy changes for you guys in a scrubber fit, you know, scrubber post IMO scrubber world?
Well, you're going to, I mean, eventually things get arbed away. You can't have a situation where you have a whole bunch of companies who are just going to be focused on the spot market, and then just because they're going on the spot market, people who normally, customers who do time charter, decide, well, we're just not going to time charter. So eventually, you'll have what you have today, which is, you know, the time charter market adapts to your vessel's fuel efficiency anyway, and what a time charterer is willing to pay for each separate vessel. So you may see an index of what a top 1-2 year time charter rate is, but a time charter will clearly pay more for a vessel of, you know, higher performance than lower performance. You just may not see that published detail all the time. So eventually it won't matter. And I can see in the certain size ranges and certain positions that, yes, there's going to be that temptation, and the temptation from our side too, to increase the number of vessels that are going to be in the spot market. But partly that's going on anyway right now. You know, we're about as long as we've ever been, or as spot as we've ever been, simply because we think the market itself for the last, you know, 6-7 weeks is improving, and we think the market will continue to improve on balance. So
yeah. Okay. So this is really helpful. We're getting towards the end of our discussion, but I want to hit on one last topic, and I'm going to go start with Hamish because I know you've got a tight time constraint where you have to be somewhere at noon Eastern time. But at a high level, it seems like, you know, the demand, the supply side of the dry bulk equation is kind of moving in the right direction, and increasingly so. You've got this really positive catalyst vis-a-vis IMO 2020 that's positive for all shipping verticals, frankly. So it seems highly apropos that the equity values of these companies, of your companies, are moving in the right direction, really for the first time in half a decade. So that's very encouraging for the industry. I guess, you know, in that context, you know, we have to address the dry bulk depression that we had in 2016, and the capital structure, capital allocation, really issues that the industry had as a whole, and what you've learned from that, and how the business will change going forward. Because at the end of the day, the 350, 400 people on this call, you know, or you may want to buy your stock, and a lot of people that have bought shipping stocks over the last 5 years have lost all their money. And so how are you as managers, and I'll start with Hamish, what have you kind of learned from what's happened over the last 5 to 6 years, and how does that kind of inform how you're changing the business and the way you allocate capital to the business going forward?
Well, our intention is to take advantage of what we believe will be a strong market to delever. And we want to get our debt down as low as possible, ideally to net zero, before the next inevitable downturn in the dry bulk market, which, you know, will happen someday.
And where are you now relative to that in terms of leverage, net leverage, relative to sort of the gross asset value that you guys have today?
We're about 50%. We're at about 50% net leverage.
And when you say zero, you're not talking about debt to capital. You're talking about LTV.
When I talk zero, I'm talking about no net debt.
Zero debt. No net debt. Zero net debt.
Yeah.
Got it. And Robert, how about you? I mean, what's interesting is you have, I would argue, an under-leveraged balance sheet today, which is really, really different than how most shipping companies operate at kind of at this point in the cycle. Is this kind of the new normal, or do you expect that once the market starts getting you more interesting, that you may want to, you know, take the leverage up a little bit more to grow the fleet?
Well, I think, you know, superficially you could think that we're under leveraged, but, you know, at the same time we got masses of operating leverage. You know, we got 50, 55, you know, very modern ships with all scrubber fitted that are on, you know, effectively all on the spot market. And we have we're the largest shareholder of the world's largest product tanker company, which arguably is the area that's going to benefit most from these, you know, emo changes. So in one sense, yes, the balance sheet has got reasonably ill leverage, but, you know, we've got masses of operating leverage too. And I think at the moment it's we need to be aware of your first statement, which I think you were generous, you know, that the industry as a whole in shipping has been in a bear market really since 2008. Not 5 years, it's, you know, going on 11 years now. And, you know, I think the good thing is that period has been so brutal, especially leading into 2015-16, where you created a 50-year low in bulk, that's actually setting up the position that we have now across many areas of the shipping industry, where you've got, you know, low order books, which is essential relative to historical positions. You've got no appetite for speculative capital, neither, I don't think, any of the people you have on this conference call are prioritizing allocating capital to increasing the order book or, you know, speculative new buildings. I don't think investors want that. And you've also got a shortening or a closing of capital available from the debt side, which is forcing some form of discipline on the industry at the moment, at a period. So I think right now we're happy where we are. I think it's much more about, you know, let's say, creating value. I mean, look, I think all of our stocks, all of us would agree that our stocks are trading significantly below net asset value, despite the rally that we've had. And, you know, right now, you know, we really don't have any great ambition to add to the operating leverage that we have. I think we...
Yeah. That's clear. I want to just let Paulus finish here, and then I want to make some final comments, if it's okay. Paulus, you have run your company. You have a significant stake yourself in the company. You run it very conservatively from a capital perspective. But just maybe a quick 30 seconds or 1 minute view on kind of how you look at operating your business from a risk management perspective, and kind of after what we've gone through over the last, as Robert said, 10, 11 years.
Yeah, look, the last 7 years, the market has been very weak. And, you know, we survived comfortably, I would say. We didn't sell ships. We grow our fleet, and we're still there, and we have a decent liquidity. I mean, the most important, I think, in shipping is a company at all positions to have liquidity. Now, I don't see us going into ordering new ships anytime soon, you know. And always, as a company, we have the belief that we shouldn't order more than what it is our analogy of our fleet size. You know, to add a new building every year, it wouldn't harm the market. But if we are a company of 40 or 45 ships and we add 10 new buildings in a year, then it's disaster. This, because we are ship owners the last 60 years, my father and myself, you know, this will always be in the back of our mind. You know, we are ship owners, like in Star Bulk, Petros Papas is a ship owner of 50 years in the business, 40 years in the business. You know, we are very careful of not doing mistakes that big companies usually do.
Yes, yes, and your stock price is up 29% in the last 5 days. So obviously the market, that's resonating with the market. So the final comment for me, first of all, thank you all, Paulus, Hamish, and Robert, for being part of this. I think it's been really insightful and an important critical time to have this discussion given what's going on in the market. The last thing I'd like to leave all our listeners with is, you know, we at Deutsche Bank, you know, have been relatively bearish over the last 5-6 years during the whole dry bulk downturn and the shipping downturn. I would say that me personally, as kind of the lead shipping analyst and with my partner Chris Snyder here covering shipping stocks, we have never been more excited about what the opportunity is for equity values in the shipping space over the next 2 years. We think IMO 2020 is real. We've done a tremendous work on it. We feel really good, and we feel these companies have been de-risked from a balance sheet perspective to really maximize operating leverage and minimize risk that comes with high financial leverage. And so, so we're excited about it. Last thing I'll leave you with, Hamish, I know you got to go in 2 minutes. 1 year from now, when we redo this conference call, where will Capesize rates be in the middle of 2020?
With a scrubber or without a scrubber?
It shouldn't matter from a ship owner's perspective, should it?
No, it matters. Without scrubber, the Cape rates will be good.
Okay.
You know, I'm thinking, you know, right now they're mid-20s.
Yep.
Are they going to be better? You know, I guess probably.
Okay.
I guess probably they'll be better than they are today.
I think the point is having sustainable levels, right? So year to date, they're not anywhere near 25 or whatever it is. So, like, just talk about the sustainability earnings power of a Capesize vessel in a post-IMO world, in an IMO world, I should say.
Well, I mean, it's going to be good. With or without a scrubber, you know, the charter rate should be more or less proportional to the fuel price, frankly.
Okay.
And if the fuel price is going to go up by 50 to 100%, you know, the average Cape rate during 2020 is probably up by 50 to 100% from 2019.
And that obviously has implications for every vessel size. So we're coming up on the hour.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it there, if it's okay. Thank you all for joining. I hope you found it a useful, productive use of your time. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody.